the NFL podcast. Insert generic money tag here.
Welcome to another edition of the Around the NFL podcast. My name is Dan Hansis. I come to you from a virtual room filled, and I mean filled, with heroes. Mark Sessler, Greg Rosenthal, and yes, the great Chris Wessling. What's up, boys?
Hey, Dan.
There he is.
Sounds good.
Wes is back.
Back in. Yep.
Wes on the flagship show. You know it's going to be good. How are you, buddy?
Well, we can't promise anything beyond the next hour, but I'll give it my best for that hour. Feeling okay, just trying to get rid of this pain. That's been the main problem all along, is just pain. My doctors are pretty happy that the tests are showing that the cancer itself is under control.
Excellent.
It's just that we found nothing to give me relief from pain. So that's the next, I guess, the next frontier.
Unbelievable. Well, that is great news in one part and frustrating news in the second part, because we know how long this has been going on now. But you're a tough SOB, my friend.
And that facial hair is looking hot. I mean, whether you're struggling, the facial hair is not struggling.
Well, I have to keep up with my son, not facial hair wise, but cuteness wise. You know, he's getting all the Instagram love lately. So
I think we should have a special focus on not assigning Wes to anything related to Chicago's offense in terms of reducing pain and annoyance.
That feels fair.
So with Wes returning to the flagship show, and yes, this is our comprehensive look back at the Sunday that was in week 9 of the National Football League. Wes was our eye in the sky, checking in on various games, and the rest of the gang here had our game assignments. And of course, Nick Shook will join us a little bit later. He hits a couple games every Sunday, so we got the whole thing working. And before we get going, Sizzler.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Sizzler, that, you know, the cough button didn't hold.
Well, that was a disaster, and that's the second time I've been completely embarrassed, you know, on live air, if that's what you want to call it, with a cough.
We could edit it out, but we won't.
No, I know we will not. Like, I understand where this is going. Apologies to the hundreds of thousands of people that were dismayed by that. That was gross.
And, yeah, you mentioned the numbers of listeners. That's a nice segue, Mark. Good recovery, even if it was accidental. Ricky, come in here real quick. We did our first recap of Week 9 was Thursday Night Football. Packers-Niners tilt that was sleepy, to say the least, especially if you were a fan of the team up there by the Bay. And this happened during, you know, the grips of the presidential race and the counting of the ballots. And we wondered at the end of that brief recap if anyone was listening, and to send us a little hashtag. And I happen to be wearing a Godzilla t-shirt, so Ricky suggested, why don't you make it Godzilla? If you're still listening at the end of the recap, hit us up on Twitter. Well, it turns out by Saturday morning, hashtag Godzilla was trending in the UK. So,
wow. Amazing.
Incredible. Well, testament to our listeners' loyalty right there.
We put the over
the whole sound. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Erica, which I found to be a bit of a La Reveal Magnifico, that she basically just drowned out these responses from these loving listeners. But we had put the over under at 10 responses. And I think that it was closer to 10,000. I mean, that's stretching it a bit, but I'm going to say 10,000.
Got to check 10,000. The channel and see if some creature isn't crawling out of there. You get a hashtag like that.
So, yes, that was very cool, too. So, all right. So, thank you to the listeners. We got a lot of games to get to. Let's start out with a great interconference showdown.
Josh Allen in the gun, maybe. Takes a snap, going to keep it himself, runs to his right, gets inside the 5, into the end zone, touchdown Buffalo. Josh Allen, it only took one play to cash in on Tre'Davious White, amazing interception, touchdown Buffalo.
John Murphy, sounded like he was up late, a lot of Americans up late this weekend. Voice gave way a little bit, but he got the call out, WGR. Josh Allen threw for 415 and 3 touchdowns. He rushed for another score, leading the Bills to a 44-34 win over the Seahawks in Orchard Park. Allen entered this game in a personal slump, but Seattle's defense was the perfect remedy. Even with Carlos Dunlap on the field and Jamal Adams, wreaking havoc near the line of scrimmage. It didn't matter because Seattle can't cover anybody. And that was my big takeaway from the game. This has been something that's kind of been on the radar of a lot of people, myself included, that the Seahawks defense is just such an issue that it's hard to take them serious as a true Super Bowl contender. And I thought it was interesting what Pete Carroll and Ken Norton did here. And I would be curious if the scientists could give me a little more insight if this is typically how they run their defense. But they just went mad with the blitzing. They were just bringing the house at Josh Allen. And I don't know if they scouted Allen and said, if we can just disrupt him that way, we're going to find a way to take advantage of mistakes, as Allen is prone to, of course. But it got to the point where it was just they were coming after him every time. And if they weren't getting home, and they did get home. They had 7 sacks, Seattle's defense. But when they didn't get home, it was, you know, an open prairie field in the secondary, and the Bills just kept piling up points. They got off to a 17-point lead. As you might expect, Russell Wilson and the Seahawks mount a comeback and make it a one-score game in the second half. But Wilson, again, just like in their first loss of the season, he has such a thin line of error that, and I'm talking about the Seahawks as a team, if he doesn't play perfectly or close to it, they have a good chance to lose if they're playing a good team. And he had 4 turnovers in this game. 2 interceptions, 2 lost fumbles that accounted for 16 Buffalo points. And that's how it went.
I think that Pete Carroll is going to have regrets. And I want to watch this game more closely. But I heard his comments after the game where he said, we had a real nice plan for their running game. And that they were very surprised that they totally ditched the run. Which seems crazy to me. This is the NFL, and no one watching the Bills, despite them running the ball pretty well the last 2 weeks, would consider them a better running team than a passing team. They had 2 good matchups the last 2 weeks, and they ran the ball well against them. But it's the NFL. You always got to start by stopping the pass. And to put it even in more context, the Bills have been stopped by a pretty consistent game plan over the last month in terms of Josh Allen, of backing off, not blitzing, making him sit back there and make decisions and slowly, move the ball down the field and see if that's how he's going to make a mistake. So it seemed, just listening to you, that it plays right into the Bills' hands.
I can see how Pete Carroll's approach, to answer your question, Dan, the Seahawks are not known for blitzing and getting after quarterbacks. They don't really get after quarterbacks at all.
Right.
It could be game plan specific. Maybe the book on Josh Allen, according to the circles that Pete Carroll runs in, is this is the guy you have to pressure because he can get rattled. But like Greg said, this is a passing offense. And moreover, they're a passing team. They're a bad defense and they're a bad running team. So what do they have left? The passing game. And I don't think it's any coincidence they looked a lot better with Smokey Brown healthy. He's a bit of a Jenga piece for them, had not been playing well, had been injured and missing time, and they really missed him. To me, this team lives and dies with Josh Allen. He is their offense.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Carroll also said after the game, I didn't recognize that contest. I didn't recognize that game.
They've been in it every week.
Well, but it doesn't happen every week in terms of Russell Wilson throwing 2 killer picks, being destroyed by Jerry Hughes, losing 2 fumbles. He's been pristine. They've been relying on a completely pristine version of Russell Wilson. And when that falls apart, this happens as well.
So to that point, and credit Brian Daboll and the Bills attack, they call up their first 22 plays of the game, 20 are passes. So this was a concerted effort to attack Seattle's defense through the air. Allen threw for 156 yards in the first quarter alone. By the half, he was up near 300 yards with 3 touchdowns already. So it was 2 touchdowns already. It was really another ugly affair for Seattle's defense. And Quentin Dunbar stood out to me as someone that was a major target in that secondary. He was getting picked on all day by Stephon Diggs. And to the point where he eventually got benched in the fourth quarter. Lyndon Stevens comes in. And you tell me. And, Jamal Adams returned. He was there. he makes impact plays near the line of scrimmage, but there are also several plays in this game where he's running through the secondary chasing guys after they lose him on route. So it's like, I don't know. Obviously, Adams is a big gain to this team in terms of his playmaking ability near the line. But for a team that can't cover anyone, that was never his forte with the Jets either. They just have a lot of issues. And for the Bills and Josh Allen especially, after those four great weeks and then four so-so to bad weeks for Allen, to get back here and now be 7-2 and being in control of the division, you got to be feeling very good.
It's such a massive win for them. We said it coming off last week, how should you feel about them? And I said, in a sense, they should feel okay because they have the players to play better, and they're 6-2. So the whole season is still in front of them. They have big-time goals. But to get a convincing win like this where you put 40 up there, their defense, they're kind of playing the same game as the Seahawks, where their defense just needs to be average. Seahawks have not had an average defense. I think the Bills' defense should get to being average, and maybe this, at least turning the ball over against, you know, forcing four turnovers is a start in that direction.
All right, so let's move now to all three late games went down to the final play just about. So let's cycle through a couple of them, starting with a trip to the desert.
This will be a 49-yard field goal. Let's see. Kick is up, and the kick is good. And so we're tied with one.
Missed it. It shorted it. Yeah, it was right down the middle, and it was if the wind came out and blew it dead.
What a break for the Dolphins.
Oh. I thought the same thing. It's Jimmy Cephalo, Jason Taylor, Joe Rose, WQAM. You know, I had a lock on the line here at the Cardinals, and Zane Gonzalez lines up for the 48-49-yarder straight down the middle. This is this is the NFL. We don't fall short on anything sub 50 in this league in perfect condition. So that was a stunner for the Cardinals. And that was the difference, because Tua Tagovailoa and the Dolphins really showed up to play in the desert. They escaped the desert. I'm going to just keep saying the desert, with a well-earned 34-31 win. And that's four straight wins for the Dolphins, Greg.
I mean,
unbelievable.
I made, you know, a little sound going into it because, wow, the Cardinals, Dolphins making it all the way to the second spot in the show, but it deserved it. I've had a bad streak of picking bad games coming into the Sunday. I've had a lot of clunkers, so this one was good. This one, you know, maybe gets me on a winning track here because it was one of the most fun games I've had to watch all year. Tua
good one.
Versus Kyler, and Tua Tagovailoa, I think, has to make Dolphins fans so excited. And we can go into kind of the strategy of what went into that field goal attempt and everything that happened in the last couple of minutes, but I want to take it back to the end of the third quarter. It was 31-24. The Cardinals were rolling. It felt like maybe the Dolphins had given their best shot. They're backed up against their own goal line. It's 3rd and 9, and after that point, Tua had one of the best drives I've seen all season by any quarterback. A 3rd and 9 where they come after him. They get the pressure quickly. They get the matchup they want really quickly. And he throws a perfectly accurate throw to Hopkins on 3rd and 9 to the right shoulder, or else that might have been a pick six, but it was so accurate, he gets it done. Then another 3rd down where he evades a number of different Cardinals rushers, looks athletic, picks up the 1st down, has a 17-yard throw to Parker, and then down towards the goal line, he makes an athletic play just kind of with a twitchiness that makes you feel like, wow, this guy has got some of his juice back in his legs, and, you know, cap the drive with a beautiful touchdown pass. And that drive just made me feel like I already felt like it when they made the decision, because I think they have to see what Tua was all about. But that drive was kind of the moment where it was like, well, of course this was the right move, because they need to have this guy on the field and see what he can do the rest of the way. And he is already showing the type of potential that he has in a game like this.
I mean, that 17-yard run that he had that was electrifying. And, you know, we're up here where you're watching all these games at the same time. And I thought that, you know, lost in last week's Miami victory was
Miami.
The fact that Tua just did not look good at all. I mean, the whole offense didn't. I think they want to surround him with a strong run game, and they are battered at running back. They just can't do that right now. And so a lot of it falls to him. And today was such a positive step. And, you know, Dolphins fans have gone decades without a quarterback to root for. We all know that, you know, post Dan Marino. you saw something today, and I think it goes beyond just Tua too. This is a mentally tough team. They're really well organized. They do something with special teams every week. Every time I look up Emmanuel Ogba, who was a cast-off in Cleveland, is making plays. It's a bunch of guys who probably the average fan has not heard of, but will hear of soon, because this team is intriguing. They're 5-3. They are a threat.
Yeah, Greg mentioned that you have to see what Tua has this year, just because you have to make a decision next year at quarterback. But I thought it was interesting. Go back a week, and Jay Glazer with Fox Sports reported that the Dolphins made this decision for this year. They believe that Tua gives them a better chance than Ryan Fitzpatrick the rest of this season, and that was eye-opening to me, because you just don't see this situation in the NFL. You see a lot of times where the team isn't good, so why not go with the rookie? But the Dolphins were playing well, reaching their peak in an open AFC East, and they decide to go with a rookie because they think he's better.
And, you know, there was also another report connected to Tua that circulated this weekend. ESPN's Adam Schefter reported that the first and second round picks the Dolphins have acquired from the Texans played a role in the decision to start Tua. As crazy as this sounds, they have enormous draft capital at the highest level of the drafts this upcoming spring. And they are not ruling out the idea of going after another quarterback if they don't like what they see from Tua. So they want to get him on the field as soon as possible, which all makes sense. It's also kind of mind-boggling because right. He's played four quarters, and now it's like he's playing for his job.
Although
somehow.
They made that report even before he got the starting job, to be fair. But it totally makes sense, right?
Yeah.
But didn't it popped up again this weekend, though? Maybe it was phrased differently, but
people,
it was
yeah, they
the fact
started
that that's out there right now.
Yeah, he Roto World, for some reason, you know, noticed it a week later. And it makes sense. And I think it's because you got to see him play in a game to know. And I'm sure they love what they saw today because he's crafty. I mean, and that,
ooh,
that's not...
Beastie
he
Boy
doesn't,
song.
He doesn't necessarily, you know, have every trait that you look for in a number one overall pick. His arm is not stronger than the NFL average. He said he felt like he was running in quicksand today. He's not slow, but he's definitely not a run first guy. But man, his decisiveness and his way he keeps his eyes downfield and the way he made defenders miss too as a runner, even if he's not like the fastest guy, and just kind of a feel for the game that is hard to define from a quarterback. It looks like he has that. And some of these quarterbacks coming into the league, they just seem so much more ready than they've been. I mean, crafty can also mean a very high ceiling. I think Ben Roethlisberger and Philip Rivers are crafty. You know, Teddy Bridgewater's crafty too on a different state, but that's the type of quarterback I think Tua is going to be. And man, like I'm not going to say he outshined Kyler Murray, who was unbelievable, but he in the end, he got the better of him.
I mean, Patrick Mahomes is crafty. That guy does something crafty
right.
every week.
Right.
I'm going to get on Cliff Kingsbury for the second time in 3 weeks for being a little gun-shy in a big moment. Didn't love bringing out Zane in the first place there.
Yeah.
That game felt set up for Tua v. Kyler, and these two guys were going to settle it. And I kind of thought that Kyler Murray, after they fell behind there on the Jason Sanders field goal, the second one, that he was going to lead him down the field to score. And they got a little bit of rotten luck, the Cardinals, where they kept on falling short of the first down marker by a yard or so. It happened on three different occasions. It led to a turnover on downs. It led to the missed field goal. With maybe a little better luck or a better spot from the officials, I'm not talking about this right now, but I would have loved to keep Kyler Murray on the field, 4th-and-1, when a long field goal is the alternative. That didn't quite add up to me, and you ended up getting burned by not being aggressive.
Plus, you've named someone Zane, so there's things are going to be. It's going to be an up and down.
I was like a lot of people, just like the announcer there, that I put my head down after I saw it was, you know, middle of the uprights. I don't know. I just sometimes don't watch the field goals all the way through, and then hear
that was good.
Hear the announcer say it's short, just because you'd never expect a 49.
You never see that.
He hit a 56 yarder earlier this season, but to your point on the short yardage. As great as Kyler Murray played, and we should point out he had 4 touchdowns and only 5 incompletions, and he ran for 106 yards, and his running is the most unstoppable play in football. This was the best game I think he's ever had running. He did have that fumble that was returned for a touchdown where he kind of ran into it. And then on the 3rd-and-1 play you mentioned right before the field goal, the throw was there. People killed him for the play call in terms of throwing the ball, but he just kind of short hopped the throw. So on one of his best days I've ever seen him, he just had a couple of regrettable plays. And You can't make plays like that against the Dolphins. They'll make you pay. I like this Dolphins team.
Miami's.
They're fun. They're a good team. Henry Hodgson, Neil Reynolds, all those Dolphins fans are having a little bit of fun this year. All right, let's move on to another epic finish in the late games.
1 second on the clock. Herbert's going to take the snap. Four-man rush. Lob it to the right. High. Caught. Grabbed in the air. Shaking. Touchdown. They went over to 6'8", Donald Parham.
Still has a review here.
They're looking at the replay as that ball popped out on the ground.
The ruling on the field has been changed. The receiver did not maintain control of the ball
throughout
the process.
Oh. Jackpot! Vegas wins, baby!
Brent Musburger. That's his call. Jackpot. Vegas wins, baby. KRLV. Yes, for a moment it looked as if the Chargers would finally have a storybook ending of their own in the final seconds, but no. Lucy pulled the ball away from Charlie Brown once more. Raiders 31, Bolts 26 in Hollywood Park. Actually, twice. This one was crazy. I mean, we talk about the Chargers every week blowing games, but this one. Twice in the final 5 seconds of game time, Herbert appeared to connect with the receiver on a game-winning score. You had Mike Williams with 5 seconds to play. He nearly comes down with the ball, doesn't survive the ground. Then you have Parham. Donald Parham, who appeared to have the game winner until we got to the sixth or seventh replay. And it's only then, and that's what makes it, again, with the teams that are truly the teams that are in the pain, the true top tiers of the pain rankings, it's that little extra bit of pain that separates them. And the Chargers are the team that the first 6 replays show a game-winning catch. The 7th replay shows the ball clearly hitting the ground. So instead of a season-saving win, it's likely curtains for the Chargers at 2-6. And the 5-3 Raiders, they probably know they got away with one tonight.
I don't know what to say anymore about this Chargers team. I mean, it's epic. I know, like, the pain rankings, you don't change them each week and all, but this stretch is wild. This last couple years of Anthony Lynn is just wild, the different ways that they lose. And this felt like it was going to kind of be a flip situation, you know, just because they're the ones with the ball at the end. Herbert played great. Some of his deep passes were just outrageous in this game again, but it's the same thing every week. He plays great and they find a way to lose.
I think from a game-to-game experience, the Chargers are something, there's really no rivalry. Like, what they're going through with these last-minute implosions, there's nothing to touch it. Mm. At the same side, I would not put them in any pain ranking right now watching their quarterback the way he plays. Fair. It's just, to me, from a larger bird's eye view, and I think Chargers fans, like, they have a right to feel, you know, heartbroken after a game like this and all these other string of issue games. But at the same time, like, you are watching someone who's going to change the NFL and change the Chargers forever. I mean, he's literally going to completely alter that franchise. And every time they have the ball, you feel that they can do anything. And their downfield passing game is so active, so vibrant, so dangerous. I thought they gave the Raiders a complete run for their money and could probably beat any team in the league if they were, I think, frankly, a little bit better coached with some of this last-minute stuff. I mean, and it probably puts ownership into a weird position depending on how the season ends, because now you have, like, a precious jewel at the center of your offense. You want to treat it correctly. You don't want to be in these game situations where you don't trust the coaching staff. So they've got to prove to ownership that they can pull these games out. You got the rest of the season to do it, but the DNA tells us they cannot so far.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Mark. I know I think about sports pain a little bit differently than most people, because when you've got Justin Herbert, and maybe he's not Dan Marino, where he comes in and you haven't seen a quarterback like this before in your entire lifetime as a rookie, maybe he's not quite that, but to see a guy this aggressive and making that many chunk plays and big plays and under pressure every week, and you're waiting for it to stop and it never stops, it just keeps doing it week in and week out, to me, that's the best hope you got. There's no pain at all there. I mean, I know they keep losing in the now, but they've already got Derwin James out for the year. They're not going to be a Super Bowl winner. To me, this is a good feeling team just because of what you got going on in the most important position in sports.
I know, you guys, that's a nice viewpoint to have from 35,000 feet, but if you're living and dying with your favorite team, you're not feeling too hot right now. You're right. I agree. Justin Herbert changes the trajectory of this organization. We talked about it when they moved to LA. Like, who do you build this team around to get people excited? Well, there he is, Justin Herbert,
yep.
The 22-year-old who's doing it week yep. after week. But, I mean, that is the big picture. The small picture is that this season is, in what's too many seasons as a Chargers fan, do you have regrets about how games end? The fact that they're piling up week after week, and Herbert, as great as he's played, like, it's incredible. I think he has one win and four losses, and he could easily be close to undefeated right now, but they just don't know how to close these games. Let's give a little bit of credit to yes. Isaiah Johnson. Because he is a second-year cornerback for the Raiders. He's the one that knocked the ball out of Mike Williams' hands in the end zone. And then with 1 second to play, he was involved with knocking away from Parnum, too. So he played a major role in the Raiders, a team that no one is in love with, but you have to respect that they're 5-3 halfway through the season, and they're going to be around in the playoff picture to the end. That's what I think. Anyway.
I like him.
I saw Derek Carr make a couple amazing plays. We all, you know, the diving, you know, put his body into peril for his team, the way he dove over that one player. I mean, just making a couple money throws downfield. Like, I feel like my opinion of Derek Carr has sort of been the same. I've been disappointed with him for a really long time. It's going to take a little bit more for me to get out of that headspace entirely, but this year's version of Derek Carr is what Raiders fans have been saying he's been when I've never bought into it. I mean, this is a tough,
I am
tough quarterback. Derek. I will not even try. Just go on with your sound effects.
I am Derek.
I think it's
go on with.
I think this is the best Derek ever. I think maybe he saw Dan's inspirational words. I think this is the best season he's had. I always thought that his quasi-MVP, where people said he was in the MVP mix, was a lot of smoke and mirrors. You know what Derek Carr you're going to get each and every week. He's not – I'm not even saying he's a top eight quarterback to me, so I'm not going crazy, but he's very steady. He's improved some of his weaknesses, and they're a team that's a problem. They really are. By the way, though, I do want to say, like, the Chargers make their own bad luck. Their special teams messes up every week. They're the worst special teams in the history of football. Dead last year in DVOA. Dead last this year. They fumble it and set up 3 points at the end when their defense actually closed this game out very, very well. And then Anthony Lynn didn't take a timeout during that last drive. It blew 25 seconds off the clock just because he had a total mind freeze. And they didn't say a word about it on the total mind freeze. 25 seconds on the last drive of the game would have given him at least one more play at the end there to try to go.
That's what I mean. We're like, if you have a crafty front office and ownership group, you have to take a strong look at this. We all love Anthony Lynn, the guy. But this doesn't happen just due to bad luck. There are decisions that you could diagnose week after week that point back to coaching.
Wes, you're not buying the Derek Carr love. I can see that.
No, I think it's another recency bias. I mean, it's crazy. There's a reason why he was mentioned in the MVP debate, because he was the one carrying that offense. This year, it's a Josh Jacobs-centric offense, and Henry Ruggs is the wild card. Like, he's the one who provides the spacing. I don't think it's like Derek Carr's playing out of his mind. Now, I respect the way he's playing. He's been the hardest guy for me to grade because I feel like they kind of coach around him at times. It's not a quarterback-centric. He's not the engine that makes that offense go. That's why he's hard to grade. And I think he was quite a bit better a few years ago.
One last thought on Lynn.
Missed that scientist heat.
Oh, yeah.
That was nice. When... last week, Greg, you had noted he had a kind of like a visceral, guttural reaction on the sideline when the game got away from him on the last play. It happened again when they finally made the decision. They made the announcement that it was incomplete. He like reached up instinctually and grabbed at his face guard, his pandemic face guard, and just like yanked at it. Like just lost control of his own body. He was just like in like a nightmare that he can't wake up from. Tough times. Oh, before we move on, I had to see what happened with our good buddies Matt Money Smith and Daniel Jeremiah, who call the games for the Chargers. So, Ricky, can you cue it up to when they announce that it's not going to happen, that it's become clear it's an incomplete pass?
And now the Raiders are celebrating because they saw it took 6 or 7 different replays to finally come up with that angle.
I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen anything like it.
I'll tell you, DJ, the signal went up, from John Jenkins, and I didn't want to call it a touchdown. I really didn't. I saw it, and I was like, I'm tired of doing this. I am tired of calling touchdown, only to have it taken off the board.
No, that's
and
good.
Yet again, it will be taken off the board, and it will result in another loss for the Chargers.
Oh, money's dying. I texted
gotta
him
make like
he's
a,
dying.
We've got to make like a mixtape of like Money and DJ and these last second calls that you give to a Chargers fan. Like, if you broke up with a Chargers fan, you give them that mixtape.
They're killing him. The Chargers are killing that Money Smith. All right, let's move on.
Takes the snap, gives it to Jonathan Taylor, off right tackle. He's got a hole, crosses the 40-yard line, still churning all the way down to the 36. Ball comes out. It's recovered by Chuck Clark along the near sideline. Colts 40, tripped up by Mann, hurdles Phillip Rivers, 20, 10, 5, touchdown Ravens. Chuck Clark picks up the fumble that was forced by Marcus Peters, and the defense puts the Ravens right back in the game.
Jerry Sandusky, WBAL, with the offense scuffling, it was the Ravens' defense that got things going on Sunday. Chuck Clark's 65-yard fumble recovery and touchdown put Baltimore on its way to a 24-10 win over the Indianapolis Colts at Lucas Oil Stadium. Mark, this wasn't the get-right game we expected from the Ravens exactly, but they got it done.
They did, and it was for their offense, I thought it was, you know, another one of these tale of two halves type contests. They had 55 yards at halftime, 2.2 Whoa. Yards per play, 18 yards on the ground. This is a team that, you know, bull rushed the Steelers for 200 down the stretch last week. They were not that team. And, you know, you preview these games and you call like a strength on strength, the Colts run defense versus the Ravens. And usually one of those two just don't add up. I mean, by the end of the game, you could point to both sides and saying that they got the work done, because that 55-yard first half had a lot to do with, I think, a Colts defense that has incredible team speed, had exactly a great game plan to diagnose Lamar Jackson. Al-Qadeen Muhammad had a play where he blew up Lamar Jackson for a 13-yard loss. Danico Autry was snuffing out Lamar on a third down right before the half that just prevented Baltimore from getting on track. There were one guy after the next. I thought DeForest Buckner got in there. I mean, Darius Leonard, it's a week-after-week story when he's in there. They're a completely different defense. They made life so tough on Baltimore. And, you know, you went into halftime thinking, this offense might just completely be broken. And because maybe enough teams have shown and put up tape on how to beat Baltimore at this point. The Ravens defense gets a ton of credit for me, because you get the Chuck Clark touchdown. You get a huge turnover in the second half that led to a Ravens TV touchdown. And this is good coaching. Marcus Peters had an interception that essentially they called it just sort of a dropped ball. Harbaugh went back and challenged it. And essentially they called it, I mean, it was an interception that Peters himself fumbled. The Ravens recovered, but that turned things around and led to a hard-fought Ravens touchdown on the ground by Gus Edwards. And to me, Baltimore found their offense a little bit in the second half. They fought and found their way back into this thing. The Colts offense is a hot mess from what I see. There is no anchoring force. Phillip Rivers has his games, but this was not one of them. They really struggled. His longest completion was 21 yards. So as much as the Colts defense nearly gave this game to Indy in the first half, I think Baltimore's defense showed up to be the one by the end of the game that kept a really sinking offense alive until they found some life themselves.
That Peters interception call to me was the play of the game.
Yep.
That changed everything, and it was a very shaky call. I think you ask the average sports fan at a bar how that should be called, and he would say incompletion, not interception. Yep. It was a very shaky call. Give the Ravens credit, because they completely shut down the Colts after that. And to me, we can blame Phillip Rivers again, but they've got the same problem they've had all year. These rookies that they're counting on, Jonathan Taylor and Michael Pittman, and you can throw Paris Campbell in there as a second-year guy, this is supposed to be the big play element in their offense. Taylor and Pittman specifically were brought in to fix the lack of big plays. Taylor's been terrible, absolutely brutal this year. And he was bad again today, had a very costly fumble. Pittman's not making big plays. Paris Campbell's injured. T.Y. Hilton's out. You're asking Phillip Rivers to be a big play quarterback when he's got no big play elements on his offense. Mm.
Right. They had 1 yard in the third quarter, and it's due to a lack of those guys you mentioned showing up, where you thought by now that would be it would be the opposite.
But they're playing against a Ravens defense that, other than that Chiefs game, has been the best in the league, you know, statistically. And they're pretty
close today.
They're pretty close to the best in the league statistically with that Chiefs game. They are a better Ravens defense overall, I think, this season than a year ago. And Lamar is now 25-5. You know, the Ravens are 25-5 in games that Lamar started. And the two biggest reasons for that are their run game and their defense. And for the most part, I know they struggled to run the ball today, but they're still, you know, one of the top two or three rushing teams in the league. For the most part, they have that this year. I don't know how far they can get by with their passing game doing this little, but they have the run game, they have the defense, and there's still a lot to deal with.
Jonathan Taylor did not receive a carry after his first quarter fumble until 6:15 to play in the fourth quarter. He finished with a season-low 6 carries for 27 yards. The Colts averaged 3.5 yards per carry as a team. And this doesn't feel like it's going to work. They have a good defense, but if they can't really run the football, putting that much on Phillip Rivers' plate in 2020, this seems like an experiment that will be doomed to fail unless they figure out something.
Well, they need the guy. They need everyone healthy. They need T.Y. Hilton healthy, and then maybe
that guy's always hurt now, though.
Maybe by early December or mid-December, they're a different offense. But right now, they don't have the juice.
Big TNF this week, Colts, Titans, you know, because you're right. Those two are, to me, are pretty well below the top tier in the AFC. You could argue the Titans on that. But that, you know, the Colts find a way to win that game, then they're feeling okay.
All right, let's move forward.
3 seconds left. He's back. Steps up. Throws it for the goal line. And the pass is broken up at the goal line. Minka Fitzpatrick. And that ends the football game.
The end of the game.
The Pittsburgh Steelers are 8-0. And they barely survive a great effort by the Cowboys.
Oh, man.
My goodness, gentlemen.
Felt like light up a cigar there. Wow.
Very relaxed vibe there in the booth. Minka Fitzpatrick put the finishing touch on a strong game by breaking up Garrett Gilbert's desperation end zone heave. The deflection allowed the Steelers to escape Jarrah World with a 24-19 win. Mark, when we previewed this game, we talked about the possibility of a Steelers blowout of biblical proportions. What happened?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when a bunch of talking heads get together and make predictions, they often go wayward. This went completely wrong. I think that, you know, Garrett Gilbert's a little bit better than people planned for. And, you know, this was Pittsburgh's defense all year long. They have been getting to the quarterback and causing total havoc. That didn't happen in the first half here. And Pittsburgh's offense just looked completely out of sync. You know, maybe Mike Nolan, I don't think it's ideal that you say my offense or my defense will start to look like what it's supposed to be in weeks 8 and 9. But 2 weeks in a row, they've looked pretty solid. A guy like Leighton Vander Esch, to me, I'm seeing some speed. I'm seeing a little hint of the old Leighton Vander Esch of old. Neville Gallimore, their third-round pick, had a huge game today. And Big Ben, you know, he looked to me seriously injured when he had that knee hit in the first half, and he rallied. I mean, this is sort of the experience of Big Ben. He has these injuries, and then he has sort of the flashy hobbling around and makes the heroic throw. And he had a touchdown drive right before the half that probably saved the Steelers team. Came back in the second half, didn't look totally impacted by it. But it, you know, it just sort of lessens what Big Ben can do, I think, in general. I would point to Jalen Smith, though. This is someone who's not going to enjoy watching film this week. Cowboys linebacker Jalen Smith. Dallas was up 19-15 in the fourth quarter. Alden Smith had a fumble recovery of Big Ben and was racing down the sideline. This probably could have given Dallas a legit chance to win. Jalen Smith was nailed with illegal contact, wiped that out. And the Steelers go on to a field goal drive that gives them a 19-18 lead. They then, with 4 minutes left, Jalen Smith is hit with a killer roughing the passer call on 3rd and 10 that would have ended a Steelers drive. The Steelers
Little ticky-tacky, I thought.
I thought it was ticky-tacky, but I mean, it's still, you know, if I'm going to go by what Romo says, they basically said you cannot do what he just did. And yeah. So a lot of these calls feel ticky-tacky to me. This is not 1976. They don't allow them to exact punishment like they did in the past. But that was a killer flag that led to the Deontay Johnson or the Eric Ebron touchdown. With, you know, minutes later, Deontay Johnson had that 42 yard catch and run, which was really the first big play that Pittsburgh had. And then they just hung on. I mean, this was not the Pittsburgh performance that you'd want. What I think they did effectively, though, was that when Garrett Gilbert had a chance to really give the Cowboys a game-winning drive, they went five-man rush, they got in his face, they made life tough, and they destroyed him on fourth down. And he had one chance at the end, you know, to do it. And I think Gilbert showed them a lot. He looked better to me than Andy Dalton did in that one game. And Gilbert, you know, do not forget, was the rather fascinating Orlando Apollo's AAF passer of the year, and also that team went on to win the championship in that league. So Gilbert is someone that I think coaches around the league know about. Steve Spurrier said that the only difference between him and Nick Foles is that Nick Foles makes $20 million wow. a year, and Garrett
why they
Gilbert
start
makes
DiNucci?
70,000.
I mean, is it fair to get on them for starting DiNucci?
You know what
Garrett
it was?
Gilbert?
I don't. Gilbert was signed off a practice squad. Yeah, I don't think that he had a full grasp of the offense. And they said that Garrett Gilbert though. Basically stepped in and learned the offense quicker than Cooper Rush. So, you know, look, he came
fair.
In and he looked good. Looked good for what you'd think a fourth-string quarterback would do. So yeah, I don't know what it means for Dallas, but this was an odd game. Pittsburgh, I think, just had that one week where they were not themselves.
Yeah, I don't think Garrett Gilbert looked so good that you'd kill the Cowboys for starting someone else.
Yeah.
No.
He was definitely an upgrade, but I thought he had a lot of very narrow escapes out of the pocket that could have gone the other way. And credit to him for getting out of the pocket and making escapes Houdini-like. But he could have easily had a series of turnovers instead of getting out of the pocket. Any seasoned watcher of the Steelers knows that under Tomlin, they have these games once or twice a year where it's a team they should win by three touchdowns and they go in. And they usually lose that game. Today they were lucky they were playing against the four-string quarterback and a bad defense. But I thought... To me, what was interesting, you know, outside of T.J. Watt and Cameron Hayward taking over yet another game, just dominating down the stretch, to hear Romo talk about you can't keep giving the Steelers offense more chances because look at their wide receivers. You can't keep Claypool, Deontay Johnson, Juju Smith-Schuster, and Ebron under control play after play. Sooner or later, one or all of those guys is going to bust loose. And to me, when you look at this Steelers offense this year compared to previous years, they have a loaded wide receiver core.
Right. They can't run the ball well, though. They really struggle on the ground.
I guess when you're 2-6, you're going to be aggressive. Mike McCarthy allowing Gilbert to throw the ball on third and goal at the Pittsburgh 5 with 12 minutes to play in the fourth quarter ends with a catastrophic interception. If you play a little more conservative there, you kick a field goal. I believe you're up 8 points in that situation. Instead, that was the beginning of the end for the Cowboys. I want to say one thing on the other side with Big Ben, because I know it's not a popular sentiment on this podcast or really anywhere, but I think Big Ben is a tough guy. And I thought it was interesting. He's an old man at this point.
You say he is or is not?
Is not a tough guy?
He is a tough guy.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. He just plays
nails. And I get the fun kind of element of it that he plays up injuries, and I think there's an element of truth to that. But at this point in his career, he takes a hit on his knee where you could tell he's in a lot of discomfort. Not only does he stay in the game, he takes him all the way in for a touchdown where they only pass the ball on the drive and limps into the locker room and then comes out and throws two more touchdowns. That's why he's going to the Hall of Fame. I've really enjoyed watching him his whole career as a quarterback. Put everything else on the side, and today was just another example of that for me.
I think it's like a classic Big Ben game.
Yeah, I think that's why he's interesting, because you don't see that combination of a guy who is actually tough yet plays up injuries as if he's got a hangnail and it's going to kill him. It's a weird combination, and he's had it his whole career.
And this team's tough. It's a fine line between, you know, you thinking they're lucky and they're, you know, one of the lesser 8-0 teams that we've seen. And the flip side, which is, wow, they've proven they can win games in the last, you know, 15, 20 minutes of each game. If that's a learned trait, they have it. They've done it basically 7 out of 8 weeks where that game was in doubt within the fourth quarter, and they close and they do it time after time. And I think there's something to that. You're putting a little deposits into the mojo bank. You can cash out in the playoffs.
Mojo bank.
Oh, that is very well done, Greg. Let's move to the Music City.
Foles tries to screen it. Montgomery on the right side. Big Jeff is there. The ball comes loose. The Titans pick it up. 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 5, end zone. Touchdown, right. King took it to the house.
Mike Keith with the call. WGFX. Welcome to Nashville, Desmond King, the slot corner, making his Titans debut after a trade deadline move from the Chargers. Scooped up a loose ball, took it to the house. 63 yards, knockout blow for the Titans in a 24-17 win over the free-falling Bears, who have lost three in a row. Greg, Tennessee's beleaguered defense found the right get-right opponent.
They did, and they should get credit. You know, they didn't have Clowney on the field. They did a great job. But
how do you win without him?
when it's weakness on weakness, and one weakness dominates, I tend to just put more on the weakness, on the bigger weakness. That's the Bears. And so to me, it's more about the Bears' offense than it is about the Titans' defense. Let's count the ways the Bears' offense was embarrassing in this game. The Titans were kicking their kickoffs short to the up man and letting the Bears start at the 30-yard line because they were so confident the only way the Bears could score a touchdown would be Cordarrelle Patterson. So, okay, ouch. You just start at the 30. There was what I like to call a six and out, where you go three and out, and then you do a fake punt, and then you go three and out again. So that's like a bear. And I've seen that a few times over the years. Like, they had a six and out. So
I love it.
What they got to that six and out because Barkevious Mingo ran the ball for 11 yards on the fake punt. He was their leading rusher, the Bears, through eight drives of the game. The Titans went into this
door,
game.
Sessler.
I got a couple more. The Titans went into this game as the worst third down defense in NFL history, just about. The Bears were 2 for 15 on third downs. And finally, here's what to me summarizes the Bears' offense. There's so many plays in this game where it was third and long, and they tried to do give-up plays, like where they would throw the ball 4 yards on third and 15, or they throw a screen on third and 13.
They specialize at that.
But they couldn't complete those. Those guys were covered. Like, the Titans knew they were going to throw the ball 3 yards on third and 15, and so they couldn't even complete those. And the touchdown that King had was on one of those plays, which was a screen that they were all over, and they ended up, you know, forcing a fumble and returning it. So it was one of the toughest. I know they put some points in garbage time, but it's one of the toughest offensive games I've ever seen.
I mean, PFF said basically graded it as the worst Bears first half since 2006. And so I had people telling me, hey, look at Foles' box score. It's the same as Justin Herbert's. No, it's not. No, it's not. Don't tell me things like that. Don't tell me that when I have to watch this offense week after week, that is reducing my joy of football. And if you're a defensive coordinator studying for how to stop the Bears, are you done by like Monday night? Have you figured it out by Monday night?
I can't believe Bears fans did that to you and came in your mentions like that. I would imagine most of them would be disgusted.
Well, I labeled them at that they had, you know, quickly moved right back into the painfully annoying zone, which they specialize in every week. And it's like there is no growth, no development with the players here or the scheme. It's all devolving. And so, I mean, if they stick around with this, they stick to this coaching staff after this season, if I'm a Bears fan, you get a little bit close to that Chris Wessling zone of I might have to ignore this team until they show me that they actually are striving for competence.
I like the idea of ignoring this team. I would just like to point out, aren't there like two different levels of incompetence going on with this Bears offense? You have the normal incompetence, which is every week. And then you have today where they were without, what, four starting offensive linemen?
Yes.
You have to at least point that out.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. But you can also point out, like, the Titans had 12 transactions on Saturday. 12 transactions related to COVID-19 and injuries and practice squad. They're missing their left tackle. Roger Saffold got hurt their shoulder today. Their first-round pick, Isaiah Wilson, comes in there. He was struggling. They didn't do well. They had 7 3 and outs and 11 drives. They actually were outgained in this game by 150 yards. The Bears defense played awesome, about as well as they've played great all year. And this was, you know, another great performance where I think that the Titans had 3 points in their first six drives. There were more punts in the first half of this game than any NFL game all season. So the Bears defense did their job, but Derrick Henry, like on a 3rd-and-2, drags the pile, and they end up scoring a touchdown on a perfect throw and a perfect catch that like no defense could stop to AJ Brown, and that's what good teams do. The Titans, they found a way, but Vrabel called it a crossroads game, and they are all sorts of banged up on both sides of the ball and got COVID issues. That this Thursday night game is going to be tough for them. I mean, teams right now, it's like I feel like we need someone on the podcast. It's like Stat Boy that just comes in to give context at the end of each game and lists the innumerable COVID and injury issues on each team, because it's just like such a huge part of every week.
Who's going to fill that role?
Fun gig.
right.
By the way, the fastest go route Allen Robinson will ever run is the one out of Chicago in free agency.
Oh.
Let's move on.
Also, to play devil's advocate with myself, Joe Burrow was missing 3 offensive linemen and had the best game of his career against that Titans defense. So.
Right, exactly.
Well done. Well done. Moving on.
This would be an NFL record field goal to win the game. This will be a 67-yard attempt. Chiefs have to be careful to hold their water. Slide, big leg. The kick is up, and it is way right. It's no good. What is good? Kansas City gets the victory to go 8-1 at the bye week on a hard-fought victory.
Mitch Holtis with a call, WDAF. You know, one of these days, Joey Sly is going to reward Matt Rule's faith with one of these 70-yarders. But it wouldn't be Sunday as Sly missed, as you heard, wide right. Panthers fall 33-31 to the Chiefs at Arrowhead. Mark, Carolina did just about everything right in this game, but they still couldn't find a way to close out the champs.
I am really proud of the Panthers. I don't feel that way about football teams that often. They came in and fought so hard, and the Chiefs, by the game's end, did everything that you'd expect the Chiefs to do, and we can get into that. But Kansas City rolled into this prepared for a fist fight. I give them credit for being, or the Panthers rolled into that, and they were just so aggressive. Their opening drive, 15 plays, 75 yards. They wiped out 9 minutes of the opening quarter, and that included a drive where they went for it on 4th-and-3 to allow them to move on and get a touchdown to Christian McCaffrey. His first game back, he looked pretty good. They're not using just him, though. They still have a little bit of Mike Davis going on here. On the next drive, though, okay, I just thought that they put they put their foot on the pedal and did not let up. They got into a 4th-down situation. You're seconds into the second quarter. They roll up a fake punt. Joseph Charlton, the punter, hits Brandon Zylstra for 27 yards, and it leads to a touchdown drive by Curtis Samuel, a pass to Curtis Samuel. There is later in the game, Teddy Bridgewater, what I think is one of the plays of the season,
yes.
A dangerous scramble into peril, 15 yards on 3rd-and-14, and it says everything about what Matt Rhule and Teddy Bridgewater want to do together, and the faith that Matt Rhule mentioned in Teddy Bridgewater in the offseason when we talked with him. They come out of that, and with 10 minutes to go in the game, they dial up a fake punt, because in some of these teams that get overly cautious and just going to hand the ball back to Kansas City, it didn't work. It didn't go their way, but you cannot kill them for it. They just absolutely went for every chance they could to get an edge. At one point, they were down 33-31 at the end, and they fought their way back. I don't know, just they have an element to them under Matt Rhule where they've refused to give up. That said, you're still dealing with Patrick Mahomes, who threw 4 touchdowns. He has 9 touchdowns and 2, you know, over the last couple of weeks. He looked absolutely beautiful today. It's just bend but don't break against the Chiefs, and then suddenly you break. They're too powerful on offense. And this, you know, the Panthers do a few good things on defense, but the idea of containing Patrick Mahomes the whole time, impossible. But the offense fought and fought. And this is a fun Carolina offense to watch. Their parts work right now.
Teddy has had good weeks. He's had bad weeks. He's had throws he can't make. He's had throws that maybe you'd be surprised he can make. But to me, the most impressive thing about his season is if you've watched every game, you'd never know he had a career-threatening injury. He has not changed the way he's played. He has, like you said today, Mark, sacrificing his body, like at the first down sticks, diving, what, 5-6 yards in the air going forward to get that first down. He has thrown caution to the wind in a good way, like not to the point where he's going to get himself injured, but he knows when to slide, when to go down, when to go for the extra yards. And you just never know that he had a major knee injury.
Yeah, his courage in the pocket, his pocket presence, I think, is his best trait. But that's it's also why, and it's not like I focused on this game, but these great effort Panthers games, you want to finish one, and they had their chance. Right. They had their chance to win in Arrowhead. They had the ball, and they only needed a field goal. They had 50 seconds. It's not all the time, or more than that, with no timeouts. Not all the time in the world, but they threw two checkdowns in the middle of the field. To start the drive, and it was almost over right there. And those are mental errors, and there's something he'll learn from. But a Brady or a Breeze, they're throwing those balls out of bounds because they know those 2 yards, throws over the middle ultimately kill you. And they kind of ran out of time there because I really was excited to hopefully see a Joey Sly winner. But you're not going to hit it from 69. Thought he had the distance though, Dan, but he missed it by about.
Yeah, this time he might have actually been cleared the crossbar, but it wasn't dead on this time. Yeah, Mahomes is just such a treasure to watch. He's now 32-8 in his career as a starter. He's got the MVP award. He's got the Super Bowl MVP. He is up to 25 touchdowns this year with one interception. And his numbers, Wes, I mean, give me an update where he is on your quarterback rankings, although I suspect I know where he is. He's at 67% completion percentage, passer rating of 116, and he's at career high marks in completion percentage, touchdown interception, touchdown to interception ratio and passer rating. Is this the best you've seen him look?
No. I think his first year as a starter, when he was the clear-cut MVP, I think that's the best I've seen him look. He's been number three most of the season in the QB index. I think Aaron Rodgers has had a better season. I'll have to look because he might pass Russell Wilson, who's had three turnovers in, two of the last 3 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
But Aaron Rodgers, to me, goes to number one on the list.
All right. Let's keep moving.
13-yard touchdown run, and the Jags are a two-point conversion away from a tie with a minute 30 to go. Here they go for the tie. And here's the snap for the deuce. A throw right side, and incomplete. Too low for Chark, and the Texans lead by two with a minute 30 to go.
Mark Vandermeer with the call, KILT. So close, Jake Luton.
Luton.
So close. The Jaguars rookie nearly pulled off the comeback in his starting debut, but that two-point conversion attempt to DJ Chark, no good. Texans hold on 27-25. Greg, Houston has shown an ability to keep any team in a game this year. Add the Jags to that list.
Yeah, they've shown an ability to beat the Jags. They're 2-0 against them and nobody else. This game, I think, can be best described by explaining the exploits of Josh Lambo. Didn't think I was going there. But it was a Lambo type of game. Early, missed extra point.
Oh.
Ends up mattering a little bit when you have to go for two at the very end with Jake Luton, who spent about 25 seconds celebrating his touchdown on what should have been a legacy drive. And then, I don't blame him. He's a seventh-round rookie who played pretty well, and then realized we got to go for two and totally short-armed. If there is such a thing as, getting nervous and your shoulder feeling a little heavy, he threw it in the dirt nowhere near his receiver on the two-point conversion. But that wasn't all of Lambeau's contributions. He had a 59-yarder in this game. How about that, Josh Lambeau?
Not bad.
And he went out of his way to get in the middle of two other guys who were fighting, which I've never seen a kicker do. Two guys kind of jawing, and then Lambeau comes in there instigating. And if you look at him, it's not too shocking because Lambeau and a lot of these kickers are jacked these days, but Lambeau's another level of kicker jacked. Yeah. So, he's like the Jaguars. A lot of fight, a lot of spirit, and they lost in the end.
Late Thursday, very late Thursday, I was watching election coverage and decided it was time to put up my long-awaited kicker power rankings. And maybe Josh Lambeau didn't see himself on that list and said, I need to start kind of putting myself out there. Missing a PAT is not going to do it. But
Where was Jason Sanders?
Jason Sanders
list
was snubbed because Young Wei Koo is so good at onside kicks. But I immediately regretted that when I was watching the game.
Well, also, entries 2 through 5 were split up sentence explaining that no one's going to knock out the Ravens kicker from number one.
Well, it's
not
Justin
to get
Tucker
off topic,
one,
Sanders then has hit 20 straight now, including couple bombs today under pressure.
All right, he's number 8 now. Okay, right. Are you happy? But number 2 through 5 is kept empty out of respect for Justin Tucker.
I think that's only fair. I would have, before today, I would have had Chris Boswell higher on the list, who only had one bad year really in his career and has been a tier one kicker outside of that one bad year. He had a rough day today, and that may have been his line's fault, because I think it was Tyrone Crawford who was coming through the line every single time on the kicks.
I mean, I can hear Texans fans out there being like, we never win a game. Can you, you know, you guys are just talking about, hey, this is what happens when 2-1-6 teams go against each other. The difference to me was Deshaun Watson ran the ball today in key situations and scrambles. He had more rushing yards than any game he's had since the week 17 of 2018. And I've been waiting for that. He's so athletic, and like, he just doesn't take off. And sometimes you need to, and he did it a lot of times on third down. He was very sharp overall. And Jake Luton had great numbers, made some good plays, was lucky that he only had one fumble and one interception. It could have been more, and was playing a team that lost their two of their three best pass rushers to COVID and their best cornerback, Bradley Roby. So it's not a good Texans defense, and they definitely had some mishaps today. But for a rookie quarterback, he looked, you know, quite good. He had a nice day.
Let's check in on two more losing teams.
First and 10 from the 30, handoff. Dalvin shakes a tackle at the 25, and the race is on, and is loose! Touchdown! 70-yard touchdown this time by the best in the business, baby, Dalvin Cook.
Ooh, spicy.
Oh, Paul Allen brings the spice. I think Paul Allen's the best in business, KFAN. Dalvin Cook, yes, superstar. Vikings running back. Listen, come after me if you want. I think he put himself on the MVP radar on Sunday with his second consecutive 200-yard game from scrimmage, which included the game-icing 70-yard touchdown sprint and a 34-24 win over the Lions at U.S. Bank Stadium. You know, Dalvin Cook, he scored a touchdown in every game he's played. He has four games this year. Four. We're halfway through the season where he scored at least two touchdowns in the game. He is one of those guys, one of those very – and it's actually a great conversation, and obviously you know what Paul Allen feels about this. When you talk about who's the best running back in football – CMC, obviously, he needs to be in the conversation. Alvin Kamara needs to be in the conversation. And obviously, I think Dalvin Cook needs to be in the conversation. I think that's the big three.
Derrick Henry in, maybe.
Okay, if you want to put Henry in there too, I would have him just below, but I get that for sure. Reigning rushing champion, and he is a monster. But anyway, you know, for the Vikings to get back into the playoff picture, and I was talking about it on Thursday that I harbored some type of hope, however psychotic it is, that the Vikings are actually going to get back in the playoff picture in the NFC. Cook's going to have to be this type of special guy like Adrian Peterson was in 2012. By the way, the last running back to win MVP in the NFL. He was with the Vikings, of course, in that 2,000-yard season. He's going to need to go bonkers the rest of the way. And what's happening here, Wes, and I know Kirk Cousins is always a subject of fascination, but maybe not as much in the past this season, because he's just, his play has come down and he's just seemed like just another guy. But this is kind of what happens when your running back is playing this well and you get things calmed down and Cousins can just operate in his own little realm and do his little play action game and you don't put too much on his plate. All of a sudden, those 280-yard, three touchdown, no turnover games start to pop up again with him. And that's what he's been. He's been kind of back to good Kirk Cousins the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, because of Dalvin Cook. I mean,
right.
That it's so much easier to play the position when you have the most explosive skill position player in football, and that's what Dalvin Cook has been. The way he ran last week, 166 yards after contact, according to Pro Football Focus, that was the best I've seen any running back look all year by quite a bit. Hmm. You can say Alvin Kamara is better in the passing game. Sure, you don't want... If you could pick any running back to be one-on-one with a linebacker or safety, you're taking Alvin Kamara. But the way Dalvin Cook ran the ball, so much more explosive than any running back I've seen. And today was more of the same. He is shot out of a cannon. It's not every year you see a running back with the synchronicity with his offensive line and his own physical talent coming to the forefront for a long stretch like we saw with Derrick Henry. Late last year, we saw with Le'Veon Bell a couple of times with the Steelers. We saw, I think, for probably a couple of months early last year, Christian McCaffrey. But it's not every year you see this, and it's fun to watch Dalvin Cook, who looks phenomenal.
when he gets the ball right now, it's like they, you know, they're big on the toss. They pitch it to him, and it's like as soon as he gets the ball, it's like he's going downhill.
Yes.
And he never gets taken down by first contact. He had over 9 yards a carry last today. He went over 200 yards rushing on just 22 carries. I mean, he every time he touched the ball, it was a chunk play. And the Lions are just such a mess. There's just no progress with this team. And you try to start to get a little excited around them when they had that mini winning streak, and you saw their schedule, and you said, okay, okay, there's a chance here. But they're right back to square one. And Matthew Stafford, obviously, is having a really tough season for a lot of reasons. And he has, speaking of COVID-19, it touches all these games. He didn't practice this week because he was in the protocol, even though he wasn't infected with COVID. But he was in the protocol because of close contact. But he comes out, and he's up and down with the rest of the team before leaving with concussion for a concussion test. I don't know if he actually got diagnosed or not, but Chase Daniel finished this game. I mean, just a really bummer of a game for the Lions and the Vikings. They're hanging on the periphery with a schedule that is not too bad.
Looks pretty good. The Bears are the only team with a winning record in their next four. And that's next week, and that's the Bears. So they at least have a chance to win, you know, three of those four, get to 500. In the NFC, that, you know, that might be still uphill sliding. But I wouldn't put it past them. I wouldn't put it past them getting right back in the mix, and then Kirk Cousins having like a bad week 16, and then they aren't going to make play.
Right, but to your point about Cousins, like the environment that he's in, the three games they've won, I think he threw the ball 14 times, 20 today, and maybe 21 the other. You know, you don't have to trust Kirk Cousins if you can do this.
That's and what Mike Zimmer wants, right?
Exactly. And Kubiak. It reminds me a little bit of what they do to Baker Mayfield in Cleveland when they're playing well, which is don't have this guy throw the ball 40 times, same offense. Same with Kirk Cousins. Paying him a lot of money. All the money should be going into the bank account of Dalvin Cook right now.
All right. Wes, any final thoughts before we hand off to Nick Shook?
That was the best hour I've had in weeks. I enjoyed talking ball with you guys. It made me forget about a lot of things and just get caught up in reality. And it was a fun hour. Thank you guys for the escapism.
Oh,
same,
that's
awesome. Wes.
We love you, bud.
It's always better when Chris Wessling's around. All right, Wes, have a good rest of your Sunday. And now we welcome in Nick Shook. Shook, looking big. Somehow you look even bigger. I don't know what's going on with the bod, but it's completely out of control, and that's a compliment.
I appreciate that. You know, it's just the weekly work, Dan. You know, it's the grind. It never stops. And all those other gym-isms that I can just feed you, even though I don't subscribe to most of them.
Put out a book already. Let's get that thing going. All right, let's move on. Shook helped us out with two games. Let's start with one in A-Town. Is that a thing?
Here's Ryan, going to put it up for grabs. Jones is wide open for the Atlanta touchdown.
Wes Durham with the call, WZGC. Good call. Matt Ryan and Julio Jones are in a vintage groove of late. The veteran QB threw for 284 yards and three touchdowns, including that 21-yard strike to Jones. The Falcons roll to a 34-27 win over the Broncos, who can't get out of neutral. Shook, the Falcons have played pretty well since the Youngery 2.0 era took hold.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say necessarily that firing Dan Quinn was the answer, but it definitely, I think, woke the Falcons up. But really, what really happened was they got a lot of key guys back on defense, and they've played well in the last few weeks. I know we've talked about it on the podcast before. I know Greg's tweeted me about it. They look like a different team because of the reinforcements they got, like Keanu Neal, and the you know, continued improvement of some of their linebacking core. Foye Olukun, something like that. I always struggle with his name. He's a really exciting player to watch. And for the most part, that's all they really needed. I mean, when they played earlier in the season, their offense did enough. They just couldn't do enough defensively to kind of even things out. And today, you know, they got stops early. They stifled Drew Lock and the entire Broncos offense. And they used that to score a bunch of points and build themselves a lead and managed to hang on. And I think if you, in any football game, if you take that kind of approach, you're more than likely going to win. They almost falconed it away, but not this week, not in Atlanta.
Well, but you know what? The Falcons are falconing. This is what the Falcons do. They start out slow They totally bury themselves, and then they go on a run that like makes Arthur Blank think they've turned the corner. That they do it every year. Literally, their defense, it's always the same script too. It's the defense especially starts poorly and then comes on. Now, they've started this little run a little earlier. If it wasn't for that ridiculous Todd Gurley, you know, touchdown that he scored by mistake, they'd be 4-0. And three of those four wins would be fairly convincing, which is hard to do in the NFL. I don't care who you're playing. They're a pretty good team that at least for the national games, they'll be on the rest of the way. And they do have a few. It's like, I'll watch this team. And that's the like low bar I want a team to clear. They're going to clear that.
To your point, the Falcons are 3-13. If you combine the first eight games of the last two seasons, 3-13. And they're 7-2 in the back nine of these two seasons. So, I mean, I don't know how I think that's the point you're making, Greg. I don't know how this really helps the organization because you're not getting a high-end draft pick if you keep this up. But you're also instilling some sense of hope and you make the games on a base level. And Mark, you and I have struggled, and of course Nick as well, have struggled with this with years. You would sign off if your team was just fun to watch and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, instead of just getting your ass kicked year after year. So the Falcons make things interesting to watch, but they're not actually, you know, moving in a positive direction, it seems.
You know, it's kind of funny because a few weeks ago we were talking about trade everybody, trade Matt Ryan, trade Julio Jones. Well, you can't trade Matt Ryan because it's financially prohibitive, but people talked about it. And now that they've actually kind of figured out who they are a little bit, that's like the last thing on anybody's mind, and rightfully so. And today, he made the most of not having a fully healthy receiving core, you know, missing Calvin Ridley, but he was spraying the ball around to all kinds of different guys. Olamide Zaccheaus, Russell Gage, among the group of guys who got involved. He had a touchdown pass to Julio Jones, who ran a beautiful post corner that left the safety looking for his jock strap, if those are still a thing. It was just a good day offensively for them. And I do give credit to the Broncos, you know, because we do have to talk about the Broncos at some point in this game, because they had a really strong fourth quarter, but they sleptwalked through the first three quarters and the Falcons took full advantage. And I think that's what a winning football team does. It's kind of a bummer that they dug themselves such a hole, and especially with the losses that they suffered early in the year, you know, the loss to Chicago, the loss to Dallas. Those are games, like Greg said, they should have won. I mean, right now, they'd be looking at, what, 5-4?
Should have lost last week, though.
Yeah.
And it's like you had a chance to build off that miracle win last week, and then you go and you lay an egg against the Falcons.
Yeah, but you know what? 2 weeks ago, I don't know if they should have lost that game if Todd Gurley figures out how to stop his momentum like a superhuman or something instead of falling forward into the end zone. So, I mean, it all kind of evens out, but it's frustrating with this team because, like, if you try to plan down the line with this team, where are they going to go? Are they going to be this team? Are they going to be that first half of the team again next year?
I think Mark tried to get in a few times, but he was muted, and it was sad. It was sad to watch.
Is that what happened to me?
Yeah.
I was waiting for you to talk.
What an absurdity. Well, I was just going to ask if this like special road leads to Raheem Morris getting hired. That would not be, that would be an improbable.
Is that what you said the first time on mute, or yes, was this something that was going to change?
It was like
the
two
world?
Different.
I am dealing with a hideous cough, and so I have to keep muting the button to cough so I can survive this show. And then, you know, probably, I've not unmuted on the other end of these. And sometimes I thought I was muted, and then I coughed and everyone heard it. So it's a second drama on top of what we're dealing with to begin with here.
It would be an Arthur Blank thing, though, because that's how Dan Quinn kept saving his job with these strong finishes. But I don't know. I mean,
it's a long way to go. If he goes 9-2, you got to keep him. I think so.
Yeah, but great. When was the last time that an interim head coach got the job full time and actually worked?
I'm with you, Nick. See, I think you can fall for that, and then they have to go.
But he's
super
either a good coach or he's
search.
Not. He's been in the building for a long time. When he took over the coordinator role last year, they immediately improved. If he goes 9-2 and you've known the guy for 4 or 5 years, look, they should know already whether they really think he's a strong candidate or not. But I wouldn't rule it out. It doesn't mean it's a continuation of Quinn.
I would just do a wide search because that, you know, Nick and I know what happens when you fall for someone like Freddie Kitchens. Now, this is not Freddie Kitchens, but it's like you fall for that late season, bump. And then suddenly you're into a real, you know, you gave up on someone who could have changed the team.
He's got a long way to go.
We got a pretty good look at Raheem Morris in Tampa not too long ago also, but whatever. Hey, Todd Gurley is on pace for the funniest 17 touchdown season in the history of the NFL. Wow. 17 touchdowns. All right, let's move on.
Smith out of the gun. back to throw. Has time, pumps over the middle, intercepted! Picked off by Logan Ryan, and he slides down to seal the deal.
Interception sealed the deal for the Giants, who nearly blew a big lead, but managed to hold on for a 23-20 win over the Washington football team. Shook, this was another game that featured an ugly lower leg injury for a Washington starting quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's not something that just like is ingrained in the franchise at this point. That would be three in their history and two within the last few years. But the guy who suffered one and managed to come back miraculously was actually pretty effective in this game and was in
position. He threw that interception, but yeah.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Before he threw the interception, he was in position to lead them on a potential game-winning drive and then threw the interception. And then, threw one more interception just to really seal things. But I mean,
he's like trying to, how can I somehow lose comeback player of the year?
Yeah.
The greatest comeback player of the year story of all time.
Oh my gosh.
You know what? Here's the thing with the whole comeback player of the year award. I am too worried every time Alex Smith drops back to pass for me to consider him for an award when I'm worried that he's going to survive the game just because of how bad his leg injury was. I mean, that is an incredible thing to overcome, which I guess is inspiration for the award. But at the same time, I just want to see him make it through a game before we think about, you know, comeback player of the year awards. Oh, and he also like probably needs to lead them to victory a couple of times, I think, in order
what
to
happened,
do that. Right?
I don't think he needs to win games to win. But anyway, what happened to Kyle Allen exactly?
He suffered, what was it, a broken ankle? It was pretty gruesome. He was carted off the field afterward.
It wasn't quite as serious as it looked. I don't know what the full diagnosis is, but it wasn't as grisly in terms of the actual injury.
So the question is does Ron Rivera now, you know, kind of like wave the white flag and activate Dwayne Haskins? I mean, because he hasn't been a factor since he benched him. It was the Kyle Allen and Alex Smith show. Do we turn back to the rookie as your backup?
I think they announced it.
Your player as your backup?
I think they said so. They're going to go with Alex Smith.
Why not?
They're going
with Alex Smith.
Yeah, I think they decided.
Dwayne Haskins is in the doghouse.
Yeah.
He gives them the better chance. That's why he was the backup, I suppose. You watched this game. I mean, they averaged 8 yards per play to the Giants 4.7. They lost the turnover battle 5-0, which is you would not expect it to only be a 3-point game. So they moved the ball, I guess. You think the Alex Smith story has a little run here?
Yeah, I think it's got some legs, especially with a team that doesn't really have much else to play for or is still trying to figure out how to play under a new head coach. And if he believes that Alex Smith is the guy, then let him run for as long as possible. I mean, if he's going to get ample opportunities, at least he'll have a chance to prove it. He was adequate or a little bit better than that at times today. But again, their offense runs into the same issues, whether it's turnovers, the two at the end, kind of inflates that total, or just not being able to convert on third down. I think what was their third down conversion rate? It was 3 of 8. So not exactly what you're looking for in a team that's trying to win a game. And that's how, on the other side, the Giants, you know, forced 5 turnovers and only win by 3 because their offense isn't exactly the best either. Although Daniel Jones was a lot better this week than he was a week ago. And the frustrating thing with Daniel Jones, I'm sure you guys have plenty of opinions on this as well, is he'll drop a dime in the bucket to score a potential game tying touchdown and then blow the 2-point conversion pass because he double clutches and hesitates because he's thrown so many interceptions that it's probably in the back of his mind. He's that kind of guy. You can't rely on him. And even though he was 23 of 34 today for 212 yards and a touchdown, it's still like, what is your ceiling with this guy?
He fumbled twice. I hear them honking about, well, he didn't turn the ball over to it. You don't get any credit that people didn't pick up your fumbles. I never understood that. Like, you either fumble or you not. And like, fumbling's just as bad as an interception. And he fumbled twice.
I mean, they closed the game with
out for that guy, Rosenthal.
I like Daniel Jones.
You do not like Daniel Jones. You want
connect
Daniel
the dots.
Jones a whole big like, article. I'm just
you
saying
want him to like Guantanamo Bay at this point. I mean, we get it. This is like 4 shows in a row where you've destroyed this person. They closed with 3 punts and then the game ended. I mean, the Giants
now fumbles that are recovered by your own team are as bad as pick sixes with Greg.
No, I said, but I do believe that all fumbles are equal. Whether you lose them or not, like, it's silly to make a case between them. That's all.
I agree.
You were saying something, Mark?
No, not at this point. I've given up on this show.
All right,
sorry, good. Mark.
Get well soon, my friend. We are almost done. We have one more game to get to. Sunday Night Football.
Breeze hangs in the pocket, throws wide, wide open. Is he inbounds is the question. Smith for the touchdown. Traquan Smith in the end zone. They left him alone, kept his feet in. Touchdown, Saints.
Traquan Smith, yes, all alone in the back of the end zone, gets his feet down. Al Michaels with the call, and that was just the first in many scores for the New Orleans Saints, who romped the Tampa Bay Buccaneers 38-3 in Tampa in one of the most surprising outcomes of the 2020 season. Saints move to 6-2, extend their winning streak, and the Bucs now three losses, two of them to the Saints, and that's a problem. Nick Shook, you were surprised as everyone else here?
Yeah, so surprised, in fact, that I might have to change my midseason Super Bowl pick. And I know that sounds drastic, but this was an embarrassing showing from the Buccaneers, who had strung together some really nice games, notably that went over the Packers when they overcame a 10-0 deficit and really ran away with that one. And you thought, well, this would set up to be a competitive game, because you could kind of discount their first meeting this year. While the Buccaneers didn't have everything figured out offensively, and they had really seemed to hit their stride in the last few weeks, and then fell completely flat. And not only did they go down 28-0 like it was nothing, they didn't have any semblance of the defense that had been such a strength for them in the weeks prior. And I know field position kind of affected that a little bit, but giving them the ball, giving the Saints the ball deep in their own territory did not help. But overall, a team that is expected to win, at least in my opinion, doesn't put together performances like this against division rivals in a division that they're probably not going to win now, unless they luck out and the Saints lose a few games and they can kind of regain the lead that way. Because if it comes down to a tie, obviously they don't have the tiebreaker anymore.
It's one of the most surprising games of the year. You have to say that. I mean, and more importantly, it's one of the most influential games of the year, because you said it. The Saints have an easier schedule than the Bucks after this. They're up one in the loss column, and they're up two with the tie break. Now, it's not crazy to blow what amounts to a two-game lead. The Bucks could still win this division, but for the Saints to play this well and the Bucks to have no answers, especially the Saints' defense, just makes you feel like, wow, this Saints team is getting better as they go. They survived a few games without Michael. They survived half a season without Thomas. They survived a few games without Sanders and Thomas and Marquez Callaway, who was back there giving them some depth. Marcus Davenport has been really good for them since he came back. And David Onyemata and that Saints defensive line threw Brady around. I looked at the stats and, the QB hits and the sacks, it's like, it's 9-3, and that feels big, but it felt like it was even more than that because Brady was pressured so many times where he had to let go of the ball early, and they had no answer. They really missed Ali Marpet, their guard, but you can't put on a 38-3 loss on your guard being absent. That was just a bloodbath.
Right, and the Bucs are one of the most or the most blessed team in the league in terms of health of their offensive line. That's the first time anyone on their line had missed a start this season. So, everyone deals with adversity eventually on your front line. And I don't remember, I've watched so many, just like you guys, Tom Brady games over the years, hundreds of games. And you remember the lowlights because they're so few and far between. So, yes, he has had tough moments during his long Patriots run where you were like, ooh, I don't remember him looking this frustrated or this down. This is certainly in that small group, a handful of games where it's just like, man, the frustration on his face and even, the turnovers. And I know at a certain point just got a desperation situation, his third pick where he essentially just threw it up for grabs. I mean, that is something Benny DiNucci does in that type of spot. So to see him so out of sorts, to see the defense so out of sorts, Levante David on numerous occasions, multiple occasions, waving his arms frantically, trying to get the rest of the defense in the right position as the Saints gain chunk plays and touchdowns. And they let Taysom Hill, who's been, a divisive figure for Saints fans, to let him come in and have a huge game in prime time. I mean, I don't want to call it a La Ravil Magnifico.
La Ravil Magnifico.
No.
For the Bucks, but also don't be so quick to say no, Greg, because this is the type of loss where it's just like, huh, we brushed the Giants game under the rug last week with the Bucks and said, ah, you know, not everybody's going to dominate 16 weeks. And then they followed up with this epic stinker. It's going to leave a mark. I'll put it that way.
It will, and they got to play the Chiefs, you know, coming up, so they'll keep getting tested. I only discount it because, you know, these teams have been changing. Godwin comes back in. He's still not quite right with his fingers. Antonio Brown added to the mix. This team has shown their high level is extremely high, and now we've learned their lowest game is extremely low, and that's worrisome. But you have 7 games to figure out, you know, what you're going to do. These teams are still kind of learning each other, especially Brady in Tampa. But it's the worst loss of his career. I mean, there were, in terms of points, the deficit, that was the biggest loss he ever had. It's the first time he's ever lost to a division opponent twice in a season. So. So we were hitting some uncharted territory.
And we didn't think the floor was this low. No one expected them to have a floor way down in the basement like this.
No, not in a game that was advertised as a potential back and forth and trading of the passing touchdown record. It ended up being only one guy finding the end zone. But to a couple points, I mean, one, the adversity thing, you know, not having a guy like Cali Marpet. If this is what your contending team, if this is how they perform when you have a situation where you're dealing with some adversity, that's extremely concerning going forward because there's no guarantee. In fact, there's probably a guarantee that you're not going to be 100% or near 100% healthy once you get to the playoffs. And you're probably going to run into a team like this or this specific team again. I can't trust this team in a playoff matchup with the Saints. I know it's really hard to beat a team 3 times in 1 year. But after what I saw tonight combined with what I saw in week 1, I mean, I got to take the Saints, not necessarily running away, but I'm pretty confident in that pick, which is not where you want to see these Buccaneers end up. And then also, it's just the fact that defensively, you know, we've kind of praised in the last few weeks how Todd Bowles has helped them, you know, whether it's schematically or personnel-wise, has helped them kind of reach, I don't know, what maybe might be their peak in hindsight by the end of the season. Makes me wonder, did you try to get too complex? You talked about all of the confusion on the field with Levante David trying to get guys in place. That's not something that should be happening in week 9. You should have
felt like
a
they
lot
sat
of that
back,
order.
Though. Felt like, if anything, they weren't as aggressive as they normally are. They, you know, if Bowles has a weakness like Rex, like a lot of these sort, like Dennis Allen on the other side, frankly, where they're a little bit of a game plan defense. When it goes bad, sometimes it goes really bad. But they actually felt a little less aggressive tonight, and Breeze played really well. We should give most of the credit to the Saints for just putting it on him in all 3 phases. Breeze made great decisions. He was so calm when he did get pressured, just like evading the free blitzer, you know, throwing open. Taysom Hill was awesome. Like, everyone on their team made plays for him. Deontay Harris, Sanders, like people, like everyone on their team just dominated. And it's worth pointing out, the Bucs have never been in any big games. None of these guys as a team have ever been in a big game. And the Saints have been in a billion big games. I mean,
yeah, but
over
your quarterback's
and over.
Tom Brady.
Right. I'm just saying this team, they're a team. And they didn't show up.
And it's amazing. They've won 13-3 the last 2 seasons. And guess what? They're halfway there again. They're probably going to win 12 or 13 games, New Orleans. And guess what? Drew Brees, for all the flaws in his game at this stage of his career, probably going to throw over 30 touchdowns and complete 68% of his passes. And the offense is going to be a top 10 offense, no matter what metric you're looking at. The Saints are going to be in the mix again.
He's got Jameis. Jameis doesn't lose to the Saints. Did you see that?
I should mention Mark isn't here, by the way. Mark was feeling a little under the weather, so he took the rest of the night off. And he doesn't get to enjoy this Taysom Hill performance because this is the first time Taysom Hill truly felt like he was unleashed in a way that really jacked up the game plan of the opposing defense.
2 defining things from this game that still really stick out to me. 1, what do winning teams do when they're presented opportunities like takeaways? They capitalize on them. The Saints capitalized on every single one that they got tonight, whether it was field position or whether it was turnovers. They made sure that they turned that into points. And the other one, the defining plays or sequence of this game for me, when it was already out of hand, was Sean Payton having no respect for the opposing defense, putting Taysom Hill back there and running the same play multiple times to the strong side, shooting power, motioning a blocker from left to right and then from right to left, and just daring the Buccaneers to stop it. They didn't stop it. It got him inside the 5-on-1 possession. He ran it 2 more times in the second half on the same drive, and they didn't stop it then either. And I think that type of confidence and also understanding that you've got your opponent in the palm of your hand. That's really, really an encouraging sign for the Saints. And I'm, you know, I'll say it now. I think I'm back on the Saints train. I didn't know who they were early in the season. They did go through a few valleys and go through some struggles. But going forward, I'm pretty confident in this team now.
Mm. Who, by the way, who gets more pissed than Al Michaels when there's a blowout?
Oh, yeah.
He was disgusted by the second quarter. He never recovered.
Because this was the big game. This was like one of the best, if not the best, on their schedule. And the Bucks, you know, go out there and give a stinker, which is disappointing. Not enough people saw Jameis Winston go creep into the back of Drew Brees' post-game interview and eat the W like he did on that GIF. So
I didn't see that. Oh.
You know what my favorite part is? Imagining Jameis Winston waiting like 10 minutes after the game so he could creep back. Like everyone else is back in the locker room. He ate the W. Yeah, Jameis revenge.
All right, good for him. And, you know, Al, and I love Al. I already miss Al, and he's still here because, you know, he's not going to be here forever. So I appreciate every game that Al Michaels calls on Sunday night. Al is show business, and Al is about ratings, and he's about the bottom line, and he is not happy with this. And it's something that makes me love him even more for some reason, seeing how upset he gets. And Collinsworth, he just rolls along in his folksy way. But Al was stewing.
Al also like about
Sessler in a bad mood stewing. Type
Al
stuff.
Is also about the math people out in the desert, too. Don't forget about that.
Oh, yeah. Always. All right. That's it. Good show tonight. We got Chris Wessling back, and that was awesome.
Heroic performance. I mean, he's going through a lot. It meant a lot to hear what he said to us that it was the best hour of his week because he wasn't sure.
Oh, that was awesome.
He was gonna do this show throughout the day, even. So we were lucky to have him.
Right. And he was being modest, but before we started taping, he even says he didn't want to mess with our flow because he hadn't been doing shows for the last couple weeks. Hell no. Wes makes our show better. Through his knowledge and his personality and just the fact that he's our friend. So this is whenever we get to do the show with him, it makes our day better. And we hope to get more of those as the season and the year progresses. Shook, you've done it again. You've been sixth man of the year. Like, who's your favorite sixth man of the year? Oh, it's got to be your boy.
Come on. Yeah, come on. Yeah. It's J.R. Smith. Come on.
It's got to be J.R. the pipe man.
Yeah, the pipe man.
That's you. That's you. You love taking your shirt off. It's just, you're just like JR.
And yes, Mark, I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, but hopefully he'll be back with us on Tuesday as well. Thank you to everybody for listening. Until then, this is Dan Hansa signing off for Quiet Storm, the old boss. Ooh, still don't have that Shook nickname locked down yet. Yeah. Working on it. The Quiet Storm, the mailman, and Ricky Hollywood behind the virtual glass. Until Tuesday.